Well, this hour we'll have conversations with Linda. Before we get into that, Linda will tell us about her conference that she attended, a couple of them in Brazil, about crop formations. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton-Howe, fresh back from conferences in Brazil. Linda, tell me about these conferences.
Yes, this past week I started in Sao Paulo with four other speakers, and then we went to Rio de Janeiro, and it was hosted by a group in Brazil called Mist Productions, headed by Marta Jaramillo and Anna Sharp. And the Brazilians are truly artistic. At the theaters in both of the cities, they had huge sheaves of wheat that went for several meters as you came into the theaters with beautiful red light warming up the wheat. And the effect was walking through wheat to go into a theater to hear people talk about the science of crop formations. And I talked about all of the work that I have done with biophysicist W.C. Levengood since 1993, in which his hypothesis seems to be held up year after year, that in many of the formations, a spinning plasma vortex has come out of the atmosphere, interacted with the soil and the plants, leaving all of these pieces of hard evidence that we have gathered now for so long, and that the spinning plasma and the heating and all the effects on the plants are truly a separation from anything that the so-called hoaxers can ever do with their boards and string. And one of the speakers with us was Gary King. He has been going into fields in England for 14 seasons. He now videotapes for a website that is jointly put together with Michael Glickman, a longtime author and investigator in England. And Gary has assembled so many videotapes going into crop formation so that they're gathering a record. And in the process, he has been trying to talk with farmers. That is one area of the population, especially in England, where there has been so much anger and there has been so much resentment. And in the last two or three years, farmers have been working so rapidly to get their tractors and harvesters out into formations as quickly as possible that some of us who are really serious about studying the plants and the soil, the formations are gone. Well, Gary talked about a really significant event in the beginning of this year. The very first formation was in oilseed rape. It was reported on May 5th, and it was at a place called Old Sarum near Salisbury in England. And this was about 180 feet in diameter and actually quite intricate for formations to appear in oilseed rape, which is so crisp and so difficult to move through. And you've heard me talk about this and interview people like Charles Mallett and Lucy Pringle and others who say you cannot move through oilseed rape without it snapping and breaking. And if you put boards down or anything like that, you are definitely going to have breaks at the base of the stems.
Sure.
Well, Gary went as fast as he could to get into this Old Sarum pattern. And he said the farmer came with a face red, and he was yelling for Gary to get out and for everybody to get out. And he was calling them, "You're vandals, get off of my property." And Gary leaned down into the soil and took a hold of one of the rapeseed plants, pulled it up, held it up in the air, and the farmer's jaw dropped, because what he was looking at was impossible from his point of view. And that is that the stem that Gary pulled out of the ground had been lying flat on the ground. But the only way it could lie flat on the ground was to have been curved. There was no crease. There was no break. And when the farmer came over and held this himself, he said, "This is not possible." And then the farmer completely turned around. He was looking at a 90-degree angle in oilseed rape and knew, as a longtime farmer, this is not physically possible. And this farmer, who started out so angry, wrote a very long article for the local Farmers Weekly saying, as a farmer, that in his opinion, that old sarum oilseed rape formation could not have been made by people. He said there was nothing that he knew of as an oilseed rape farmer that could bend stalks, especially oilseed rape, at 90 degrees throughout an entire 180-degree diameter formation without breaking the crisp, watery stalks. And that is only one piece that Gary King shared among the day-long, each of these conferences, amazing insights into crop formations and, briefly, the healing, the temporary healing of a woman last spring in 2009 at Avebury. The woman had throat cancer that Michael Douglas now has throat cancer.
Yeah, he's got stage four, doesn't he?
Yes, and this woman had been through all of the chemo, and her throat was heavily scarred. It was so painful for her to swallow. Gary had known her for about 12 years and had seen her lose weight down to skin and bones. She had never, ever been in a crop formation in her life. And Gary said, at her thin, not knowing what was going to happen to her life, he said, "Why don't I take you to a beautiful formation he was very struck by at Avebury? It was the starburst pattern. I think it was the third or fourth that came down in 2009. It was very beautiful, almost Mayan-like. And they went into the formation together. And when they came out after a couple of hours, she looked at Gary and said, "I'm hungry." She had not ever been hungry for so long. She had to force herself to eat. And Gary said it was wondrous. They went to a restaurant, and she actually ate, and she kept eating for 2 weeks after being in that crop formation. And then the effect wore off. But what is it? What is the relationship between the impacts on the 90-degree curves of the oilseed rape stalks and a woman with throat cancer, chemotherapy, going into a crop formation and suddenly having hunger and being able to eat again, at least for a while?
Jeez. That's the people at the conference just must have been in awe with some of these stories.
Oh, the Brazilians, we had simultaneous electronic translators, which made it wonderful. And after each of our presentations each day, one in Sao Paulo and then in the absolutely mind-blowingly beautiful Rio de Janeiro, the amount of intelligent questions and people coming up to us and saying, as I heard this half a dozen times, "Linda, I never knew that there was so much physical evidence," because I was presenting all of the hard data that Levengood and I have worked on. And this is the struggle in this world today, where misinformation and lies have become so-called official policy. And for those of us who know that there are completely different facts and truths, it is an uphill swim in a stream trying to report facts and truth. But when you do, my people seem to intuitively understand, they realize that there is so much in this planet now that is not being reported.
All right, Linda, let's go to the phones. Conversations now with Linda Moulton Howe, Casper, Wyoming. Jamie, you're up with us. Go ahead, Jamie.
Hi. When my grandfather was alive, he used to use eucalyptus leaves and garlic to repel fleas. I wonder if that works for bed bugs, or if there's some other herb, or maybe they're immune to that too.
Well, I'm happy to call Dr. Miller and ask her. My impression has been from talking to her that bed bugs have lived and coexisted with humans literally for thousands of years, well, at least centuries, and that whatever we eat, whatever we have around us, the bed bugs seem to have accommodated what humans have everywhere in bedrooms, kitchens, and I assume that would include garlic and vinegar and everything else. And if they are now resistant to everything except propoxyr, then it's likely that things like garlic and vinegar wouldn't do anything to them. But I will follow up, and I'll report at Earth Files if I learn otherwise.
All right, very good. Thanks, Jamie. Next up, we have Rick in El Paso, Texas. You're on Coast to Coast with Linda. Go ahead, Rick.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie. Good morning, Ms. Howe.
Hello.
How y'all doing? I have to admit, I was half paying attention to the show, and the word that stuck out of my mind that suddenly made me pay attention was the word limestone. You all were talking about Göbekli Tepe.
Right.
And as I understood, you're saying that there's a deposit of limestone about half a mile away. Is that correct? Okay. I know from reading in my textbooks at UTEP that limestone, I don't know if you're aware of this, when it's freshly mined, it's extraordinarily malleable. From, like I said, reading my classes, I know that the ancient Mexica, before Cortes, actually could carve into limestone with nothing but obsidian tools. And as I kept on listening to the discussion, I thought to myself, wait a second, isn't this the same area that's referred to as the cradle of civilization? Doesn't that also, the whole thing begins to smack of Teotihuacan. And I'm thinking to myself, it's weird how the creation myths of the ancient Mexica almost exactly parallel that of Babylon and ancient Assyrians. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you very much.
I think you're making a very good point about the possibility of some kind of, let's say, flint-like tools. I know that they have found lots and lots of flints there on top of the hill before they begun the excavation back in 1994. So it may be that there was something about that fresh limestone that was easier to work with, but not knowing for certain, you can understand why John Anthony West says it is remarkable that specific tools that could make the drill hole in this hard stone bead, which was not limestone, as well as all of this refined, the relief and the three-dimensional sculptures, that you would think that there would be some kind of specific tools. So it is a mystery. And then how did they bury all of this once it was up? Because some of these are rising up into the air 20-some feet, these big columns, and they had been erected, according to the archaeologist, the German Dr. Schmidt, as they began to dig down, they realized that what they were finding were different soils that indicated to him that new soil had been put onto the older site. So that compounds this issue of how did they make what they made, and then how did they bury what they had made that stayed buried until the beginning of excavation in 1994, not long ago.
Beautiful. Let's go next. Colorado Springs, Colorado. Anonymous is with us. Go ahead.
George and Linda, thank you. I wanted to talk about bed bugs, but before I do that, I want to preface it by telling you that when I was a real estate agent out in California for 15 years, I was a functioning heroin addict. And it was back in those days, it was kind of fashionable. And if you were in certain crowds, it wasn't like it is now. I came back to Colorado Springs because it turned out that I got infected by HIV, AIDS, because my landlord got in there, was stealing from me, and he had used my kit, and a little bit of his blood was in my kit. I did not realize it, and I used it, and I got infected. He's now in prison, by the way. Now about the bed bugs, and that same thing is that bed bugs, when I was in California, there were so many there, but bed bugs are flat little black bugs. They're like a little coin purse that are flat, but once they are on you, they suck blood and they engorge themselves like a little balloon, and they travel everywhere. They travel in between apartments through the sockets, electrical sockets. They travel under the doors, in between the pipes and the walls, and they are very voracious eaters. And I think, you know, this is your audience. The reason I'm bringing this up is I think your audience is a great audience. They ask questions, and Linda, you're doing great by bringing up these issues, but I think this is going to be the black plague of our century. And the reason is that these little things are voracious. They will eat your blood, and sometimes they don't eat it all. And if they go to an apartment of a person that's non-infected, I just happen to have HIV, but if there's some other disease that's infected in that blood, I cannot believe that if infected blood that a bed bug has and bites a person who's non-infected and mixes that blood, that there's not going to be contamination of that person. And
sir, what I was reporting was exactly the opposite, that in all of the centuries that bed bugs have cohabited with humans up to this day, and including laboratory tests with bed bugs, inserting them with HIV, inserting them with all kinds of different diseases, they find that there is something about the bed bug system that when it excretes, which is the dark material that people find on their mattresses and the walls and the ceiling, that if it was an HIV virus or some other kind of virus or bacteria that was inserted into the bed bug, it does not leave the bed bug as a viable, we'll call it aggressive entity. And that is one of the surprises about bed bugs and part of the good story. No, HIV and various other kinds of diseases that have been tried deliberately in laboratories on bed bugs are not transmitted in the bites. Another thing, the bed bug only eats once every 5 to 7 days. When it does eat, it's true, it gorges, but their bodies are the size of an apple seed. So for them to blow up, it's not too much blood, actually. And they are not eating all the time. They eat every 5 to 7 days.
All right. Very good. Linda, we only have about a minute or so left before the break. Then we'll come back with more conversations with Linda. Where do you go next? Any conferences ahead for you?
I am working on several things now that are, I'm having to travel, but not for conferences. And the next round of conferences will start for me probably in February of 2011. And I'll let you all know when I have my itinerary firm.
Great. And you're going to send us also your holiday schedule. It's coming up again, isn't it? Wow. It seems just like yesterday.
Yeah, you know? I know. Time seems to be going faster and faster. I agree with you. It doesn't seem like it was long ago that we were cheering New Year's.
It's truly amazing. And earthfiles.com is Linda's website. And I should point out, she is an accomplished author as well. Just several of her works, An Alien Harvest, Glimpses of Other Realities, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, few DVDs out there, A Strange Harvest and Strange Harvest 1993 as well. The UFO field lately, Linda, too, has just been bursting with incredible stories, hasn't
it? Well, I talked with Robert Salas, and I know we're coming up to the break, but I talked with Robert Salas on the UFO intrusion and nuclear missile sites in the early 90s. He's a solid guy, but what does the Washington Post do? Ridicule everything with a put down. But the most exciting thing is the discovery of Gliese 581G, this Goldilocks planet that is just...
Let's talk a little bit about that.
There.
Let's talk about that when we come back and take final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, it's Friday. It'll be Friday into Saturday morning, and that means open lines. When we come back, final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. And Linda, before we go back to final calls, I want to get your take on the Goldilocks planet. Not too hot, not too cold. What do you think?
Yeah, it's true. Stephen Vogt, he's a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at UC Santa Cruz. He went out, as far as I've ever heard a scientist today, on CNN and others, and said he is saying it's 100% likely that there is life on 581G. That is the very first time I have heard a scientist basically saying,
yeah,
we're going to have life in another planet, and we're going to verify. Now,
well, and the definition of life could be a little tiny microbe, right?
Bacteria. Oh, yeah, but it's just the idea that we could very soon be going to that next stage, which this Earth very much needs, which is proof that this is not the only planet with life, that the universe is teeming with life, which reinforces the force of the universe, doesn't contradict it. And one of the interesting things to me is that that area, Gliese 581, it's a red dwarf sun. The universe is full of these red dwarf suns for some reason, probably more so than any other type. We have a yellow sun, and each of these different types of suns have had different births, different lives, and they'll have different deaths. So here you've got one of the most common stars in our universe, this red dwarf, and it has now six confirmed planets orbiting it. That is the largest solar system known in the cosmos beyond our own solar system. And going even further, Gliese 581, which is only, I think, about 20 light years from Earth, is in an area that back in the Betty and Barney Hill time when...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And she did that star map.
Yep.
And then Marjorie Fish came along, and in Astronomy Magazine back in 1984, I think it was, they did a whole story about Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2 as a binary star system 37.5 light years away. And they showed Marjorie Fish had done a three-dimensional bead pattern of all of, well, to her known, yellow suns in relationship to other suns. She was looking for suns like ours. And guess what is on that three-dimensional star? We'll call it the bead dimensional cosmos that she put together in our neck of the woods. Gliese 581, Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, Epsilon Bootes. These are various stars that have also come up in the Human Abduction Syndrome and in Kehoe's early books. There were discussions with a scientist then about what was the source of these disks interacting with Earth, and they actually were talking about some of these same suns that right now Gliese 581 is in the general neighborhood. And what I'm really
that's amazing.
It is. I think this is one of the most exciting things that's ever happened. Because
what has taken science so long to look over there? We knew it 35 years ago.
Well, depending upon the source. To the Human Abduction Syndrome was one thing. Pure science, you realize that the technology, in order to even look for planets, they call them the Earth-sized planet search, is it takes a whole new instrumentation, which for the very first time we are now beginning to have and to use. And in this case, Gliese 581 is 581G, the new planet discovered, is only about 3 to 4 masses of the Earth. And that means, George, for the very first time in general, let's say in the last 5 to 6 years, we are actually being able to look for planets the size of Earth around stars that are 20, 30, 50 light years from our solar system.
Well, this is dramatic.
I know. It's really fun. I
remember as a kid reading a story that someone had written that there was some kind of a probe going around our planet that came from Epsilon Bootes.
Yes.
That, you remember that?
This goes back to the Kehoe books. At the beginning, Kehoe was writing, and some of the others at the end, well, I'll put it right at the beginning of 50, 51, 52. And why their work is so significant is there wasn't much spin. We know that there was a lot of government spin around the three crashes at Roswell in July of 47. But Kehoe and others were able to speak with military backgrounds and work that they had been associated with, pilots that they were interviewing. There was no somebody standing over them or following them or intimidating them, saying, you can't write about this, you can't interview. It hadn't happened to them at that point, and that's why the books are so significant. And the series that were done, you're absolutely right, Epsilon Booties was in one of those lists of being one of the sources of some of the disc technology. Now, where did he get that information? I do not know.
Let's go to Jonathan, cab driver in Atlanta. Hey, Jonathan, go ahead.
Hey, George, Linda. Linda, heads up on the story tonight. They've been running all night on your affiliate here, George, about a number of cattle mutilations in a county outside Atlanta, Hall County. They even played a little clip of an interview with a cattle rancher.
Yes. Not only is it in Georgia, it is in several other states simultaneously, and toward the end of next week, I hope to have an overview of all of the animal mutilation stories that have been happening recently, not just cattle, but a whole bunch more of half cats. So go to Earth Files at the end of this coming week, and I'll have an overview of everything that I can learn by then.
A quick question, I'll get off. Have you done much investigation of the area that George Knapp describes in his book, the Skinwalker Ranch in eastern Utah, high strangeness in that whole surrounding area? I'll get off.
It's amazing to me that all started with an interview that I did with the rancher, going all the way back to the mid-90s, and Bob Bigelow of the Bigelow Foundation in Las Vegas and now Bigelow Aerospace was listening to my radio interview with the rancher. And this is before George Knapp and Bigelow and everybody got into that. Mm-hmm. And in that interview that I did, it was with Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. And at earthfiles.com, I in fact have an Earth Files that I did within the last 3 or 4 years having to do with my audio tape. I still have the audio tape from that interview. I think it was back in 94, 93, 95, somewhere right in there. And the most fascinating thing that I remember sitting here tonight is I can hear that rancher's voice. And I remember that when I was connected with him, that he wanted to talk with me because of all of the investigations I had done on animal mutilations, and they were having a bunch of mutilations on that ranch. And then he started telling me about being out at night and seeing these moving lights over his pastures, and then seeing a huge, large craft, cigar-shaped, as I recall, with very strange light along something that reminded of portholes or something, and he decided, I would have done the same thing, he decided to go out into the field and approach this craft. And as he approached it, this part, I'm not remembering whether he was paralyzed from a force outside of him or he just got so afraid, but nevertheless, he stopped close enough to be looking up through one of these, I'm going to say portholes, you could see into this big craft. And then in his mind, he was telling me, this was purely telepathic, that he heard a telepathic, like a conversation of two entities or beings that he was seeing inside of the craft that he thought looked quite humanoid. Very human-like, but sort of odd, and that what came into his mind, the rancher in Utah, from them was, don't even bother to explain. He would never understand what we are doing.
That is something. Ross is in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Ross. Thanks for calling.
Hello, hey. Long-time caller, first-time listener. I had a question about the photon belt. And how maybe that entry into the photon belt would physically manifest itself in an individual? If there would be.
Are you talking about the Van Allen belt around our Earth?
No, ma'am. From what I understand, I heard it reported July 3rd of 2008, I believe, on CNN. They reported a band of energy moving towards the United, towards the solar system, from out further in space. I also heard reports about in the 80s that they have released information about this as well, emanating, I believe, from the Pleiades constellation.
I don't think so.
No.
There was a couple of years ago. There was an analysis made. If you leave the solar system and you get out to Pluto, that is now considered to be one of the Kuiper Belt objects. It's not now defined as a planet.
Like a planetoid. Huh?
Yeah, and if you use Pluto now as your boundary to go to the next layer of our solar system, you're in the what are called the Kuiper Belt objects, and they are largely icy. And then if you go the next layer, think of a kind of a layer cake, but it's spread out into space a long way, quarter of a light year, then you get to the Oort cloud. And there was some measurement about energy and various analyses of that part of our solar system, but it did not have anything to do with a photon belt.
Okay, next up we go to Fort Myers, Florida. Carl, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Carl.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Linda.
Hi.
I just wanted your opinion. I find it a little odd that, I think, what, about 4 days ago, it was announced that the UN had appointed an alien ambassador, and then just here 2 days ago, they find this Earth-like planet. Do you find that a little odd?
Well, a lot of coincidences, you might say, are happening, or maybe a confluence of destiny. The UN, there's been a kind of history of spurts of information coming from, I'll put it this way, UN perhaps associated people about announcements, and these have come periodically over the last 20, 30, 40 years, but nothing ever seems to gel. And so on this most recent announcement, I read it, but I really wasn't sure if I was reading anything that was solid, whereas the discovery of these two new planets at Gliese 581, one of them being Gliese 581G, the Goldilocks planet, because it is in such a perfect place to have life, that is real. That is exciting, because what we're all hoping is that if some kind of breakthrough on the planet's mind, I'm talking about all humans, that now can accept that we're not alone, we're not the only life, that this huge cosmos is teeming with life, and that we can evolve on this planet with a whole new relationship and understanding with the universe around us. That's what we're all hoping for, and hoping it happens in the most positive way possible. And so right now, I'm not trying to force any associations. I think that this is an exciting astronomical discovery. And if somebody in the government decides to use this as a point to leverage open the truth, so be it. Amen. Hurrah.
These are still exciting times, Linda, aren't they?
I think so.
Let's go to Connie in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hey, Connie, go ahead.
Hi, George, and hi, Linda.
Hi.
And happy October. First, I own a little motel here in Florida, and if you know anything about Florida whatsoever, if it's a bug, it'll live in Florida. And I had got infested at the motel with bed bugs. And it was only in one room, and it was a bad infestation. I got rid of the bed. I didn't take anything off the walls. The refrigerator, the microwave, the TV, and all of that stuff, I sprayed it all down with Mean Green, which you can get from the dollar store, and I took buckets. I had carpet on the floor. I got rid of the bed. I got rid of the carpet, and I took buckets of bleach water, and I just poured it on the floor. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was standing an inch thick, and let it sit there and completely dry, and then I do it again, and I do it again, and I had to this day. And the whole time, I mean, this freaked me out. I mean, I don't like a bug. And I prayed the whole time, Lord Jesus, please don't let these things get out of this room and infiltrate the motel, because, I mean, I just don't like a bug. And I, to this day, I do not have a bed bug, and I have not had it go to any other room. And all I used in the room was the prayer, the bleach, and the Mean Green. And I don't know which one took care of the bed bug, but, I mean, it was a bad infestation, and I don't have any anymore.
Well, Linda, is this going to get?
But I sure don't like a bed bug.
Is this going to get any better, Linda, or is it going to get worse, the bed bug outbreak?
Well, I think that Dr. Miller thinks that it is here to stay for the foreseeable future. Now, worse, I don't know how much more they can expand, but I think that this heat, the heat treatment, the fact that there are technologies now that are developing and being used in hotels and being used in schools, all of these big buildings that have had so many problems, that may be the beginning of at least trying to control the spread of the infestation. And it may be that it'll take another 5 years or so for us to know, because it's a lot of money, but because the bed bug problem is so bad now, and the fact that there are people willing to invest $200,000 to $300,000 into these heat treating, then maybe it will begin to have some impact. I think, George, we're at that crossroads where it's a problem, and the likelihood is it's going to maintain and be a problem. Now the issue is, will another technology come up that's not harmful to children and to people, pets, and plants that would take out the bed bugs specifically? And I don't know if that's possible. I don't think it is right now, and so we have to live with them.
Well, and they are everywhere. Linda, thanks again for another great series of reports. I look forward to talking to you about this mutilation story down there in the South. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, and Linda Moulton Howe, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.